This is Hillbilly Solid, and I'm your host, Silas House.
This is a message and a calling. So get up and gather around everyone. I've been withering and dying, trembling from trying, barely crawling. What can I do? What will I do? Nobody told me. Nobody told me. Nobody told me how heavy this life was gonna be. Here stands a silver line believer, not believing. A rosy eyed dreamer. Into a moment when hands are not given to the meeting. What will become of an even one? Nobody told me. Nobody told me. Nobody told me how heavy this life was gonna be. Nobody told me. Nobody told me. No. Nobody told me.
Howdy and welcome to Hillbilly Solid. I'm your host, Silas House, and you just heard Nobody Told Me by the band Vintage Trouble. You should check them out. They have a great record out right now. We have an amazing lineup for you on this episode. Later on in the show, we'll be talking to one of the major authors of our time, Barbara Kingsolver, about writing, her love for Appalachia, and her latest book, Flight Behavior. Before that, we'll be hearing a wide range of music, as we always strive to do here on Hillbilly Solid. Chief among that mix, we will have some brand new music from Patty Griffin, whose new album entitled American Kid will be out May 7th, and I think that's a cause for some celebration. Always great when she has a new record out. We're going to play you a couple of those new tunes on our show today. Here's the very first single, Ohio, and you might recognize those background vocals as belonging to former frontman for Led Zeppelin and current boyfriend of Patty Griffin, Mr. Robert Plant. Here's Ohio.
Thank you. me now. Save me, your sweet, sweet love won't save me. Every desert and
I ain't found no place to hide.
Save me, your sweet, sweet love won't save me now. Sweet love won't save me now. Save me, your sweet, sweet love won't save me now.
You just heard Your Sweet Love by Casey Chambers and Shane Nicholson. That's from their really beautiful album, Wreck and Ruin. Before that, we heard You Belong Here from League's new album, also titled You Belong Here. That's Thad Cockrell on lead vocals. Some of you may know his solo work, and his new band League's is really great and getting some good buzz in Nashville. And we started off that set with Patty Griffin doing her new single, Ohio, and that's from her new album, American Kid. Well, you are listening to Hillbilly Solid with Silas House. That's me here on listener-supported radio WUKY. Let's get right back into the music. I'll be honest with you. I've been pretty underwhelmed by mainstream country music lately, but recently a new singer is making some really big new statements in country music, and she's following in the tradition of people like Loretta Lynn, who's forcing country to look at its social consciousness in a new way. Some tracks on her album have been pretty controversial, but here's one of my favorites. This is Kacey Musgraves.
Kiss lots of boys, or kiss lots of girls.
trips round the sun.
Judge not, lest ye be judged yourself. For I know you'd damn me if you could, but my friend, that's simply not your call. If God is great and God is good, why is your
take me. Take me by the willow and kiss me so tenderly. I know I belong to you. I belong to
just heard the lovely vocals of Joan Shelley from up in Louisville doing a track called By the Ohio from her great solo record Ginkgo. Before that, we heard Susan Werner doing Why Is Your Heaven So Small? I just love that song. It's from her album The Gospel Truth. And we started that set off with Casey Musgraves doing Follow Your Arrow from her really, really excellent country album. Same trailer, different part. Thanks for listening to Hillbilly Solid here on WUKY. Hang in there because we have award-winning, best-selling, and beloved author Barbara Kingsolver coming up right after the next set of music. Before she joins us, though, here's a couple more songs, including a great one that was recently produced by Jack White down in his Third Man Records studio in Nashville. It features Brittany Howard, the lead singer for Alabama Shakes, singing with Ruby Amanfu.
On my hand, I'm so confused. Uncle Sam got my man, and I'll be so glad when my man comes home. Don't wanna start nothing until my man comes home. Well, he's so handsome. That makes the poor woman scream, and I'll be so glad when my man come home. Don't wanna start nothing till my man come home.
Well, she was a pretty, good-looking young girl, and she kissed me in such a way. But to get anything, she said, show me the ring, the way they did in those days. Well, I never thought too much about it if I was the marrying kind. But any young man worth his salt or a damn has other things on his mind. Oh, get ready, Marie. Get ready, Marie. Get ready for dreams to come true. Get ready, Marie. Get ready for me. There's so many things we can do. Well, I woke drunk from the night before, on the morning of my wedding day, and the best man, best thing to do is just to keep going that way. But my pretty young bride wasn't laughing when I tripped and fell down the aisle. And though I was a pain, still no one could complain that I wasn't wearing a smile. Oh, get ready, Marie. Get ready, Marie. Get ready for dreams to come true. Story. No, our marriage stuck like a habit, but I had a good hunch when she kissed me a bunch. She could do other things like a rabbit, like a rabbit. Get ready, Marie. Get ready,
we close that set with another one from Patty Griffin's brand new album, American Kid. That one is called Get Ready, Marie. And we started off that set with a great Jack White produced track from Brittany Howard and Ruby Amanfu.
Sure, that Tijuana Brass record sounded great in 1966. And so did that album of disco Beatles covers you picked up a few years later. But you haven't listened to any of those LPs in ages. Now you can finally put all that music to good use. Donate your unwanted records to WUKY for our vintage vinyl sale coming in June. Take them to the Lexington Habitat for Humanity Restore on Southland Drive. Find out more on the arts and events page at WUKY.org.
This week on Joe's Blues, we say farewell to Public Radio Music Month. showcasing some performances recorded right here at WUKY and in Lexington. The North Mississippi All-Stars, Cassandra Wilson, and Over the Rhine, plus locally known favorites Nick Stump and Frank Schaap. It's a special edition for Public Radio Music Month on Joe's Blues. At a special time this Monday evening at 9 on 91.3 WUKY.
You're listening to Hillbilly Solid here on listener-supported radio WUKY, and I'm your host, Silas House. I am so tickled to tell you that we have Barbara Kingsolver with us today. She is one of those authors who really needs no introduction, but I will tell you that Barbara has published 14 books, including my personal favorite by her, The Bean Trees, as well as modern classics like The Poisonwood Bible, Pigs in Heaven. Most recently, she has published The Lacuna in 2009, and last fall she released Flight Behavior. She has won too many awards to list, has been named as one of the most important writers of the 20th century by Writer's Digest, has received the National Humanities Medal, which is our country's highest honor for service in the arts. She is a proud daughter of rural Kentucky and is committed to two of my favorite things, community and service. It is always so good to visit with you, Barbara. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, you're entirely welcome, Silas. There's really no place I'd rather be than on Hillbilly Solid.
Well, I sure appreciate it. I have so much to ask you that I'm going to launch right into it and try not to keep you all day. One thing that, like I said, that I'm so inspired by you is your commitment to your community and to service. You once said that your best work is accomplished through writing, raising your children, and being an active citizen of your own community. I really love that. So I'm wondering what first lit the fire of service in you.
It's so hard to look inside ourselves and, you know, kind of pull the strings out and figure out what's connected to what. I really don't know, but I can tell you that I grew up in a household of service. My father was a country doctor, and it was very clear to us that his priorities were taking care of people and taking care of the earth, taking care of the garden, and that came way ahead of material things. If material things were even on my father's radar, we didn't really, we couldn't tell it. Right. It was the ethic of our family that we wore hand-me-down clothes, and that did not matter. We tried to be the best people we could be, and that did matter.
Right. There's really something to be said for living as an example for your children, don't you think? That you just, it's like osmosis or something.
Well, it is really the only way we influence our children, I believe, is through example. It doesn't matter what you tell them to do. They're watching. Mm-hmm. And so that has been awfully important to me since I've been raising children the whole time I've been an author. Those things came into my life. My first child and my first book contract came into my life literally on the same day. So I've always been doing these things together, writing books and raising kids. And I saw quickly how being an author puts me in the world in a way that was quite unexpected to me. You know, people read my books in faraway places, even in other countries. And in modern life, there is this pull on, I guess, any of us in our careers to travel, to go far away, and to go and, you know, talk to the people who've read your work or talk to people who might be doing similar work to you. That pull was strong and incessant, and I saw early on that writers in modern times are citizens of the world, and they tend to be very public people. If you're successful at all, they want you to go not stay home and write books, but go traipsing around telling people about
right.
your book. And I just made a really early decision that that was not for me. That's not the way I wanted to be a writer, because I wanted to be in the same household with my children. And also, I thought that would not be a useful position from which to be a writer. I felt that if I have anything useful to say, it will only be because I sat tight in the place where I lived and kept my eyes open and belonged to my place and to my family, so that I might have some hope of accumulating some wisdom about belonging to a place and to a family and some wisdom about relationships and so forth. I think people read books for wisdom, and I think that's true of fiction. We read fiction to learn about not just information about the world, but how people cope with the world. And you can't write about that unless you're doing it yourself.
Exactly. Well, speaking of home, even though you've lived all over, you have returned time and time again, literally and figuratively, to Appalachia. You've returned to it in your books, and now you've returned to it and lived there again. And I think of many of your books as love letters to Appalachia. Flight Behavior certainly is. And even your first one, The Bean Trees, it's such a wonderful look at the complexities of the region. What is it about the place that gets under our skin so profoundly?
Well, there's so many things. It's language, it's a way of telling stories, it's voice, it's the kinds of relationships we have in this part of the country and the way we are bound to family and to community that might be unusual. It's the physical landscape, it's the mountains, it's all of those things. I think also for me, it's because it is home. It is where I imprinted on these hills and this kind of talk and this kind of storytelling. Just the way, you know, a baby duck imprints on its mother, and wherever it might go in life, it's looking for that mother duck. I think I followed kind of a typical trajectory for a small town girl, you know, with big dreams. I went to high school, you know, I grew up in Nicholas County, Kentucky, and I went to high school there, and it felt very small to me eventually, and I just couldn't wait to, you know, kick the Kentucky dust off of my shoes and go see the world and seek my fortune. And when I went out into the world, I didn't really understand Kentucky until I left it. I had no idea of how people saw us, and especially rural Kentuckians, eastern Kentuckians. I was shocked when I went to college in Indiana and people would stop me on the sidewalks to get me to, you know, to hear how I would say different words like all and hair and, you know, and mock me. And this was Indiana, mind you.
Yeah.
This was not Paris, France. One of my friends in my freshman year in college, who was from Indiana, gave me an official hillbilly passport that was, you know, it was this joke. It allowed me to pass over the border from Kentucky into Indiana. This was all news to me. And so my first response was to try to put my light under a bushel. You know, mm-hmm. I tried to pass. I learned to speak the way they speak on the radio. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I covered up who I was under layers and layers of trying to fit in while I was watching and learning about the world, trying to become worldly, you know, since that was the fundamental accusation, I think, is that we are unworldly people. So in the process of that, I also was writing stories. I've always loved to write stories, no matter what else I've been doing, I've been writing. And I tried writing from this new position of being a worldly person who had no accent, who had no community, who had no belonging, really. And I just wrote the awfulest junk you could imagine. But I kept trying. I wrote sonnets, and I wrote stories. And I ended up in Tucson. I lived in Europe. I just went, you know, sort of hitchhiking around Europe and getting jobs wherever I could. And I tried to see the world in my way, and did. And I ended up living in Tucson, Arizona. I was still, you know, pretty young. I was in my early 20s. And I was writing I'll tell you how The Bean Trees came about. I was writing short stories that were set in Tucson, Arizona, and I was trying very, very hard to make them interesting and sensible and believable, and they just were flat. They just, all these stories didn't have a storyteller inside them. But I had all this collection, and it got larger and larger, and then I wrote this short story called The One to Get Away, which was about a young girl in Kentucky who was just dying to get out of Kentucky and went to Arizona, but she sounded like a Kentucky girl. And a friend of mine read that story and said, well, here's your novel. Put this person in Tucson and let her tell all these stories. And bingo, I realized she was right. It was that voice that was authentic. That's the only thing I had that was authentic as a writer. And right around that same time, I began to read Kentuckians heavily, particularly some writers who were fairly new on the scene at that time, most especially Bobby Ann Mason. And I saw how her voice honored her place instead of, I guess, I was so afraid of ridicule that I had tossed the baby out with the bathwater. So I began studying writers like Wendell Berry and Bobby Ann Mason, and there are so many. Mm-hmm. Harriet Arnold is a wonderful example.
Yes.
Of people who sound Kentuckian but bring the honor of the place through their voice. And that's when I discovered my own voice. And it took me quite a while, several books, before I could write a novel set in Arizona that sounded Arizonan. You know, I
right.
could, in time, as a writer, as I matured, I could learn other voices. But first, I had to speak my own first language and really explore that and trust it.
Yes, those voices are so vivid. I know that we're all so indebted to that friend who pointed that out to you, that was... the story to tell.
Well, I think that I was mad at her for about 24 hours because I wanted so, you know, I was trying so hard to be anyone but me.
Right.
But she was so right. It is not that I was writing autobiographically. I wasn't, you know, nothing in the Bean Trees ever happened to me. I have been asked if I found my children in a car, but in fact, they were much harder to make than that. So it wasn't that the stories were about me, but they had to somehow come through me. I had to be an instrument,
mm-hmm.
like a flute or, you know, like a saxophone. I had to be a Kentucky instrument to play that song.
Yes, I love that. Yeah. Well, you are listening to Hillbilly Solid. I am your host, Silas House, and we are having a conversation with Barbara Kingsolver, the beloved author. Barbara, in all of your books, there's a real social consciousness, yet you do such a fine job of not beating readers over their heads with the issues. How do you walk that tightrope of writing a novel that has a conscious heart but does not turn into a polemic?
Well, I think, first of all, if you're a person with a conscious heart, anything you write will reflect that. So, you know, it isn't that when I write fiction, I set out to sort of lay social consciousness onto it. It's really more a question of where it comes from, how I see the world, and what questions I will ask, what things will concern me or frighten me or worry me. You know, it's the questions I ask that become the conscience of the novel. But as far as walking the line, I don't see it as any problem at all because everything has its place. If I want to beat people over the head with a message, I might go to a school board meeting or I might go to, you know, a protest or something like that. And, you know, that kind of didactic language or mandative language has its place, and that place is not in literary
mm-hmm.
fiction. I guess I begin with the ideas that resonate for me or the questions that, you know, that sort of engage with the world, and that's where the consciousness per se ends. After that, I move into novel writing mode, and in that place, I am concerned entirely with language, with character development, with plot, with constructing the fabric of a story that will be beautiful and engaging and, you know, and seem real to people and pull them in. So I kind of leave the politics at the doorway and go, you know, into my study and I sit down and I think about sentences
mm-hmm.
and think about how can I write a sentence that has never been written before and that might even take someone's breath away. And that's what I work on all day long. And then when I finish the draft, I go back and I write it all again and try to make the language even better and the characters even more convincing. So I focus entirely on craft, and I don't ever, ever think, oh, how can I make this more convincing to
mm-hmm.
people? You know, how can I make people behave a certain way or think a certain thing from this novel? Because that's not the place. I mean, we're surrounded by messages and language that's telling us what to do, mostly what to buy or, you
yes.
know, what to drink or what to drive. And people have enough of that. It's really important to me in fiction not to tell anybody what to do ever, but really ask them what they think.
Right.
It's a question of respecting the readers. I don't know what they ought to do. I don't even know who they are. Mm-hmm. Right. They're out there living some life I know nothing about, and they're going to pick up this book and read it. And that would be very irresponsible of me to tell them what to do. All I can do is ask in a kind of universal manner, what do you think? You know, here is a world. Here are some characters faced with these difficult dilemmas. What do you think? Where do you weigh in on this? And naturally, some of those characters will be more sympathetic. And undoubtedly, fiction does manipulate readers, but that's why we love it. We want to be manipulated. We want to pick up a book and just be compelled by another person's life. We want to feel what it's like to be another person who might be very different from us and kind of look out through that character's eyes rather than looking into them, which is our ordinary mode.
I think flight behavior is such a good example of that, in that, you know, we have this global issue like climate change, but really it's all about these characters and this intimate focus on, you know, particularly one woman who we come to care so much about. Can you talk just a little bit about flight behavior and the characters and the story?
Certainly. It's set in southern Appalachia in a rural farming community, much like the one where I live. I didn't really name the place. It just, all you know is that it's near enough that people go to Knoxville to buy anything you have to buy in a big city. But so it's in the range of this area where I live. And as I was thinking about this novel, because I always think for at least a year or more about a novel before I'm actually writing the scenes and the characters that comprise it, I wanted to address climate change and specifically how people think about climate change and why we have such trouble accepting a truth that's staring us in the face, in some cases scorching our crops or flooding them out. I live in the middle of this culture war. I live among farmers who are being very drastically affected by the new climate events, you know, the new unexpected, unpredictable climate. And yet these same people who are suffering the most from climate change might be the least equipped to understand or talk about it. Why is that? So I got really curious about how people make up their minds what to believe. Given the same set of facts, half the people will walk away saying, oh, that is a terrible evidence of climate change. And the other half will walk away saying, oh, that is a miracle from God. How do we make those decisions? I believe it comes down to questions of whom we trust. I think first we decide who we trust, and then pretty much we'll believe anything they say. So I wanted to write about that, how we form our communities of trust and our sort of cement our sources. And what do we do when we're presented with outside evidence or outside information? So I created this community called Feathertown and this young woman, Della Robbia, who has lived a very, very confined life. She's a smart person who had big ideas maybe in high school, but she got pregnant when she was 17 and married into this family of sort of hateful in-laws and a husband who's, you know, sweet but just dumb as a box of rocks. And she's been raising, you know, little kids, and she's hardly gone out of the house except to church in 10 years, and she's just about to explode. She just can't do it anymore. And in the beginning of the novel, she's just about to march up the mountain and wreck her life. She's going to, you know, meet some man and just, you know, wreck everything. And that's how the novel begins, by saying there's a certain feeling that comes with throwing your good life away, and it is one part rapture. I think we can all relate to this. We all do things that we know might be our demise, but we're pulled by that, by risk or by ignoring the consequences. Yes. And then instead of the man she intends to meet, she sees this amazing sight, which she takes to be a miracle, and marches right back downhill and tries to get her life in order. But from there, her life sort of explodes outward. First, she becomes the talk of her family and her church and her town, and then outsiders come in, and scientists and journalists, and the novel sort of steps up. With each chapter, her life has become engaged with a larger set of people, until there's an image of her that goes viral on the internet that's very embarrassing to her, and so she becomes a global celebrity. And then the second half of the book is Della Robbia learning to incorporate new information and sort of getting her life back under control so it steps back down to a woman on her own. So that was the structure of the novel. But I just found this community of, and this big event that happens, a good way of telling a story about climate change is sort of the background. It's the setting of the novel. It's the landscape of the novel. But really, a novel is about people and how they make up their minds about things, how they deal with things. And I thought this was an interesting setting for sort of playing out the culture war around climate change and what goes into that and what comes out of it. What are the consequences of it?
Absolutely. Well, it's a beautiful piece of work and such a vivid opening to that book in particular. Thank you so much for writing it. And thanks for all of your writing and your inspirational service to others. One final thing that I wanted people to know about that some people may not know about you is that you created the Bellwether Prize for Fiction, which is the nation's largest prize for an unpublished first novel. And it focuses on socially engaged fiction, and it's now part of the Penn Prizes, as I understand it. Why did you choose to contribute in that way by creating this prize?
Well, I was lucky enough to have this career and write fiction and to write fiction that engages with the problems of the world and to have an audience, to get to make a living at that. And so I wanted to pass that on and help other people do that. So that's why I dreamed up this prize. It's meant to be a career-founding event for a writer who wants to write this kind of fiction and who does it really well, to establish them, to publish that first novel and give them a prize that's large enough that they can go on and write more of that. And it just seemed that it was a natural thing for me to do because I do believe fiction can make the world a better place.
Me too.
I wanted to encourage other people to do that and other readers to read it too. So people can learn about that prize if they just go online and look up the Penn/Bellwether Prize. They can find out more about it. And the many books that have been published that have won this prize, I think there are 7 or 8 now.
Yeah, there are some beautiful books have come out of that competition for sure.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for joining with us a while here today on Hillbilly Solid. You make your people very proud, and we thank you.
Thank you. I so appreciate being here and talking with you, and hope to talk to you soon.
And thank all of you for joining us for this episode of Hillbilly Solid. I hope you enjoyed it. We're going to close the show with a track from a great new record I want to encourage you to check out. It's called The Quilt Box Sessions, and it's by Daniel Joseph Dorff and Ronnie Culler. You can find out more about it at olkentuck.com. That's olkentuck.com. Until next time, be good to one another. Here's Maybe for Now.